This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Upgrade your business with Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. Shop Pay boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning fewer carts going abandoned and more sales going cha-ching. So if you're into growing your business, get a commerce platform that's ready to sell wherever your customers are. Visit Shopify.com to upgrade your selling today.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome from Washington, D.C. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show, and I'm happy to say I was able to see a portion of that speech live in person, and that is going to be the gist of what we're going to be talking about today in the aftermath as the President of the United States, after the inaugural, had a speech to the joint session of Congress. Now it's done. It's a chance to review the last 7 weeks, and that's exactly what the president did yesterday. And by the way, his head of government efficiency has another job to do today. I'm just trying to think what it is. Oh, yeah, it's an easy job. He's got to get SpaceX will launch its eighth suborbital flight test on its fully integrated Starship rocket, a combination of the ship upper stage and the super heavy booster. Being that it's so easy to do, he was able to spend last night in the chamber just hanging out with no kids around, well, none of the 13. So he says the whole thing will be to catch the super heavy booster using the chopsticks on the launch tower. We know how the president loves that. The ship's upper stage will perform a soft splashdown in the Indian Ocean. and if this works good, the Starship is supposed to go to Mars. So before we get to Mark Thiessen, who is really tired of talking to me, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
Yesterday and today was a positive step forward to say we are going to negotiate this peace, and we're already talking about confidence-building measures that we'll then take to the Russians and test that side. This is going to be a tough shuttle diplomacy, but both sides have to enter into it.
So how's that? Zelensky sends a letter and Trump seems satisfied. Does it make aid flow and intelligence flow back again to Ukraine? Our peace talks next, we'll examine.
Number two.
Our tariffs will remain in place until the U.S. tariffs are withdrawn.
There is no motive, reason, or justification for this decision.
The Chinese people will never yield to bullying or intimidation or be deterred by hegemony.
Tariffs rocking markets and nations, including this one. What's the plan for today? And is the real success coming down the line? We talk about tariffs on Canada, Mexico, China, and their swift, angry responses.
Number one.
Members of the United States Congress, thank you very much. And to my fellow citizens, America is back.
And only one side cheers. Donald Trump's fifth address to a joint session of Congress, his best and most provocative, as Dems make it clear they're not impressed. They act up, they walk out, one tossed out, opposing his presence and his policies. It was embarrassing. Mark Thiessen, your thoughts on that speech, your speechwriter, which you used to do to make ends meet on the side, right for the president. So your thoughts about that speech and the reaction.
Yeah, I was actually the lead writer on two State of the Union addresses, so I know how hard it is to write a good State of the Union address. It was a great speech, a very effective speech. The Democrats, you know, I remember the last image we had of Donald Trump at the rostrum of the House of Representatives was when he finished his last State of the Union address of his first term and Nancy Pelosi tore up the speech behind him. It was such a breach of norms and protocols, such an insult. And last night the Democrats said, Nancy, hold my beer.
Yeah.
We're gonna see if we can take our country lower. This is a party. Donald Trump, the Harvard-Harris poll just came out. 58% of the country thinks that Donald Trump is doing a much better job than Joe Biden. He has 52% approval in that poll. The Democrats have 36% approval. It's like they had a meeting and said, how low can we go? How much lower can we lower our approval? How insulting can we be to the American people in this chamber to make our fortunes fall apart?
So I was able to, thanks to Congressman Dan Muser, he gave me his wife's ticket. I was able to sit right in the middle behind the center camera.
Yep.
And I saw Al Green stand up and just start screaming at the president.
Yeah.
And this guy is just a clown from Texas. He's been trying to impeach Trump from the day he got in 2017.
Yeah.
What do you, you're a guy that cares about decorum and tradition.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts about this?
Well, first of all, you on the floor of the House of Representatives is frightening to me. I mean,
no, it's upper chair.
Okay, so you're not going to go back tomorrow and cast a vote or something like that, right?
You would be worse off. I'm pretty much – I know roughly what to vote for, Mark. I would text you first.
So first, put aside for a second the breach of decorum of Al Green. How is it good for the Democrats to have an old man with a cane yelling, get off my lawn, in front of the American people, number one? Number two, the star of the night was that kid DJ, the kid who had brain cancer, which, by the way, Trump said at the beginning of his speech, if I cured cancer, they wouldn't stand up and applaud. And then he introduces a kid who actually beat cancer, makes him an official Secret Service agent, and they're sitting there on their hands, not standing up for the kid. Unbelievable.
And you met him.
And I met him. I just met him in the Fox Green Room right here. He's just on Fox and Friends. And you know what his dad told me? You know who his congressman is? Al Green.
It's unbelievable.
So this man had an opportunity to honor one of his constituents in the State of the Union address in front of the entire nation and draw attention to this wonderful kid and this wonderful family, and he chose to use that moment to make a fool of himself on national television and insult the president and everybody who voted for him. I mean, this man is such a disgrace.
Here's what he said after being tossed out, just for people to know. I was amazed. I thought to myself, what is the protocol if someone stands up? And sure enough, they bang on the gavel, and he said, Sergeant of the Arms. So you see this guy walk up. Did you notice? I don't know if it was on camera. He went up to Nancy Pelosi first, as if it's the same
room. Who the hell is she?
Right. And they talk while Al Green is yelling. Then he walks up to Al Green, and they try to talk to him. He looks at the guy like, get away from me. He keeps yelling. He walks away back to Nancy Pelosi. Then he walks back, and then they had the gavel down. Then they get another guy, 80 pounds overweight, not a big bulky guy that you see at Hooters, like when they work the door to keep, you know, people out.
You might see the club.
I like the fries.
I don't know what it's like at Hooters. Brian, but I mean,
so they tap on Al Green and then he leaves. Here's what Al Green said afterwards. Cut 9.
The president said he had a mandate, and I was making it clear to the president that he has no mandate to cut Medicaid.
What's he talking about?
I don't know what he's talking about. I mean, these people are so, you know, so think about it from the perspective of a Democrat, right? So when Donald Trump was elected 8 years ago, you said, not my president. And you said he was an illegitimate president and that Vladimir Putin put him in the Oval Office. And you spent 2 years with the Mueller probe pushing this Russia collusion conspiracy theory. Then there were the two impeachments and the 91 indictments. There were two assassination attempts. He survived it all, right? And not only did he survive it, he emerged from the 2024 election with a swing state sweep, a popular vote mandate, and a unified control of Congress and the federal government. And he's standing there like a colossus astride the country, and you don't know what the hell to do. And so I worked for Don Rumsfeld. And Rumsfeld had a book called Rumsfeld Rules, which were all of his collected wisdom that he had over the years. And Rumsfeld's first rule of holes is when you're in one, stop digging. Right? The Democrats are in a hole. Stop digging. If they want to make a comeback, just be normal. Right? The biggest problem, the reason why Donald Trump got that mandate, is because people think this party is not normal. These people are insane.
Here's more from the insane guy. Cut 10.
It is the best way to get it across to a person who uses his incivility, against our civility.
Yeah, you know what? Snap poll, both CNN and I can't remember what the other network was. 70% approved of the speech. Majority of Americans were proud to be American, were proud of the speech. The number of people who thought that Donald Trump did anything wrong last night, 16%.
So Wired contributor Jake LaHoot on MSNBC, cut 15.
The first part of it felt a lot like kind of a ChatGPT'd rehash of the inaugural address, honestly. The other part of it that stood out to me, though, you know, obviously Trump likes making some good TV. There were some clearly feel-good moments up in the crowd. But I was waiting the entire time for I am waiting for Congress to pass
something.
And it ended up being basically just the tax bill, I think. I may be wrong on that, but he did plug the tax cuts, and we're still not getting many specifics.
Your thoughts about that breakdown?
Yeah, so number one, the Democrats have obviously made clear that they're not going to pass anything with Donald Trump. I mean, look at them. You're just standing there. I mean, sitting there. So, you know,
what did they just reject on Monday?
Yeah.
They reject the child, the girls' sports bill.
Yeah.
It's the easiest thing for them to okay.
So this is the issue that lost them the election. That ad at the end of the Trump campaign, which they poured $100 million into, she's for they, them, he's for you, was the most effective ad. This is like
they're going to show that in classrooms.
I mean, truly, it's the classic ad like that. This is the issue they lost on, and they still haven't figured out why they lost. They're still doubling down on transgender stuff. It's insanity.
The thought of putting Slotkin up makes sense, though, because number one, Michigan. Number two, you got to think that Michigan perhaps might be affected by the tariffs and cars.
Sure.
Who knows?
Yeah.
And she's somebody with an intelligence background. She said, my father was a Republican. My mother was a Democrat. That's probably a move that maybe Rahm Emanuel would make or Axelrod would make. But, you know, there was a 15-minute Chris speech was unremarkable.
I actually didn't watch it. I went to bed because I had to get up to view Fox in front.
Thank you.
But, you know, I will tell you this. Almost never is – I think both sides should just not do the response. No one ever comes out ahead from having done a response, almost ever. It's just not an effective tool. You got the president standing at the rostrum of the House with all the pomp and circumstance, and then you standing there in front of a camera looking like a schlub.
Right, which is not easy to do. Yeah. Here is a Senator Slotkin, just a little bit for Mark, who slept through her speech. I will not tell her. About 19.
After the spectacle that just took place in the Oval Office last week, Reagan must be rolling in his grave. We all want an end to the war in Ukraine, but Reagan understood that true strength required America to combine our military and economic might with moral clarity. And that scene in the Oval Office wasn't just a bad episode of reality TV.
That's a little of the...
Yeah. So there's nobody who's been a greater supporter of Ukraine over the last 3 years than me in Washington, or you for that matter. And that it was entirely Zelensky's fault, what happened in the Oval Office. He walked in there with an intention to try and talk over Donald Trump to the American people, and it backfired on him like crazy. And he brought on everything that's happened in the last few days. Look, it was very clear. We all know that the person who's the opponent of peace is Vladimir Putin. Zelensky wants peace. The Ukrainians were invaded. They didn't want this war. They don't want to fight. They want to get back their territory. They're fighting bravely to defend their country, but they don't want this war to go on. And Zelensky managed to convince Donald Trump that Putin is the one who wants peace and he's not. And that's why he cut off the aid or suspended. He only paused it, by the way. He didn't cut it off. It's because he's going to turn the screws on whoever he thinks is the opponent of peace, is the obstacle to peace.
Mark, hold that thought. Yep. I want to do a whole segment on Ukraine, and then I'm going to let you go. And well, you don't have to get some rest because you went to bed early.
Yeah, no, right? Exactly. 11:30, yeah.
All right, but we'll just do one full segment on Ukraine because we've got to find out where we go from here. Because Mike Waltz says he got calls before Fox and Friends this morning. He came on at 7:30, and he's planning on having another call at 11 o'clock. So this whole story is moving.
It's moving.
And you know that too. Back in a moment.
Diving deep into today's top stories, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Great days start with great underwear, and Tommy John makes the greatest. With Tommy John, you make each day better than the last. And with over 20 million pairs sold and thousands of five-star reviews, guys everywhere love their Tommy John. Plus, you're fully covered with Tommy John's best pair you'll ever wear or it's free guaranteed. Grab 25% off your first order now at TommyJohn.com/Spotify. Save 25% at TommyJohn.com/Spotify. See site for details.
A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Regarding the agreement on minerals and security, Ukraine is ready to sign it at any time that is convenient for you. I appreciate that he sent this letter, just got it a little while ago. Simultaneously, we've had serious discussions with Russia and have received strong signals that they are ready for peace. Wouldn't that be beautiful? Wouldn't that be beautiful?
And that is the president last night from his speech, but Mark Thiessen here. Mark, the letter was good. It's about two pages. What I thought is underappreciated in it, they want vote. They want a show of confidence. Show me that you do want peace. Stop bombing hospitals. Stop bombing ships.
Yep.
Let's scale back before we scale out. So your thoughts, he said, he expressed regret about the way things happened in the Oval Office, Zelensky. Yeah. That seemed to be good enough for President Trump.
Yeah, I think Trump wants to move on and he wants to get peace. And so he accepted an olive branch. He sent an olive branch. It was an imperfect olive branch, but it was enough to get the job done.
So what happens today?
So here's the thing that we need to understand is that I've spent a lot of time, as you have, talking to President Trump about Ukraine. You look at what he says. Even last night, every time he talks about Ukraine, the first two things he says is this war would have never happened if I was president. And thousands and thousands of Ukrainian kids and Russian kids are dying needlessly. So he wants to stop the killing. Trump hates war. He wants to stop the killing. He wants to get it stopped. And what Zelensky did that damaged him so much in that Oval Office meeting, it's like Trump didn't – I mean, he insulted Trump, and that bothers Trump, but that's not the main thing. He made himself an obstacle to peace. He said he didn't want a ceasefire. He didn't wait – that Putin would never agree to it and all the rest of it. And Trump looked at him and said, this guy doesn't want peace. He hates Putin so much, he's never going to negotiate peace with him. So I got to turn the screws up on him to get him to come to the peace table, which is what I think he feels he successfully did. But Trump wants to stop the fighting. And so the smart move for Zelensky would have been to say in the Oval Office, you know, Mr. President, Vladimir Putin has – and he should have done it behind closed doors, not in the public – Vladimir Putin has violated peace ceasefires 25 times, but maybe he won't with you as president. So let's try it. I'm willing to do an immediate ceasefire and go to Putin and say we're willing if he is. And then Trump would have gone to Putin and Putin would have said, because Putin is gaining ground right now. He's actually advancing, not a lot, but they're making incremental progress. And the Ukrainians are the Russians are on the offense and the Ukrainians are on the defense. And so it would be good for Ukraine for the fighting to stop. And Putin doesn't want to do that. So then he'd be the obstacle to peace.
So we'll see, I guess, where we stand right now, because they did cut off. They paused aid and paused intelligence, which I think is hurts. But they said the Polish prime minister came out and told all the European leaders to keep calm and carry on. Just get the aid to them. Don't panic. Meanwhile, J.D. Vance sparked a fury in Britain as he seems to mock the idea of British and French peacekeepers, saying they haven't fought a war in 20 years. I'm not sure if that was his intent, but I love the fact that the British would go on the ground with 20,000. That is, to me, a legitimate tripwire.
Yeah. And I'm not sure what Vance is thinking, because the whole point is that we want to have foreign peacekeepers there. So why would you not have be praising any country, even if they haven't fought a war in 20 years, who wants to send
peacekeepers
there?
Here's the quote. Some random country that hasn't fought a war in 30 years, interpreted by politicians across the divide in London as an attack on the UK. But if you talk to people that fight wars, they think the UK are fine fighters. Just not enough of them.
Well, the UK has fought a war in the last 20 years. They fought with us in Afghanistan and Iraq.
Yeah.
So they they fought in every war with us. So that I don't think he was referring to the British and the French. But look, Trump said during the Oval Office, we're going to have the British and French have committed troops. There are other countries going to do it. And he said, we haven't committed yet, but we conceivably could. He put the possibility of U.S. forces as being peacekeepers on the table. Zelensky should have just jumped and seized that. And instead, he just gets into a shouting match with both of them. It's just incompetent.
So here's the scenario. I mean, I think it's going to happen quickly or not at all. We have a DocuSign. My tax preparer uses it. So they get the materials. They get the raw earth, the rare earth.
Absolutely.
And they sign it. And then do you think that he meets with Putin? And if they do meet, where would they meet?
Is Zelensky and Putin?
No. Trump and Putin first, and then – which I have no problem with, by the way.
Oh, I don't either.
Do you think they're at that point where the heads of state meet, or you think they need another state-level meeting?
First of all, I think one of the fallouts of the Oval Office meeting is that Trump is not going to put Zelensky anywhere near Putin anytime soon. He's sort of taken himself out of being the negotiator. I think it's going to be shuttle diplomacy. I think Trump is going to go and negotiate with Putin. Then he's going to come back to the Ukrainians and go to them and back and forth until we have a peace deal.
Right. Are they at the point where heads of state talk?
I don't know yet. I don't know.
Interesting. I think we might know by the weekend.
Maybe if he gets a ceasefire. If he gets a ceasefire, then you can talk.
Read everything Mark Thiessen does and listen to everything he says. Is that all right, Mark?
Absolutely. Same to you, buddy.
Back in a moment.
What makes a great pair of glasses? At Warby Parker, it's all the invisible extras without the extra cost. Their designer quality frames start at $95, including prescription lenses, plus scratch-resistant, smudge-resistant, and anti-reflective coatings, and UV protection, and free adjustments for life. To find your next pair of glasses, sunglasses, or contact lenses, or to find the Warby Parker store nearest you, head over to warbyparker.com. That's warbyparker.com.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
This was the most boisterous, the longest, the most partisan speech I've ever heard a president give in this kind of setting, and I go back about maybe 50 years on this. I also think it may have been the most effective. I mean, if you ever doubted that Donald Trump is the colossus, the political colossus of our time and our nation, this night and this speech should have put that to rest.
And that is Brit Hume, who's seen it all, a lot of it. And he's thought, he's known Trump for a while, too, and take him for his word. It was partisan. The first half hour was like, you never thought I was going to be here. I am back, and there's nothing you can do about it. And I'm kind of bitter what you did to prevent this from happening from the court cases on down. But you lost. Senator Steve Daines joins us now. He had so much to do with the fact that the Senate is now Republican. He's now on the Finance, Foreign Relations, and Energy Committee. Senator, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks, Brian.
First off, what was the feeling in the chamber last night?
You know, Brian, I felt like there were two countries represented there on the floor of Congress. Really did. It's remarkable to think the Democrats never stood up once on any of the applause lines that President Trump delivered, including they couldn't even stand up for DJ Kid is battling cancer. They couldn't stand up for Lake and Riley's family, the tragic stories that have happened, the consequences of terrible policies, but at least come behind these grieving families, and they couldn't even do that. I thought his speech was spot on. No doubt it was going to be partisan. But look, it's not unusual to see partisan speeches. I've sat through a lot of Obama speeches. I've sat through a lot of Biden speeches. And there are times you stand up as a Republican when Obama delivers an applause line or Biden delivers an applause line. They sat on their hands and scowled the entire night. And I think it backfired on the Democrats massively. They don't know what to do right now to stop President Trump's basically his advance on his policies.
So there were 14 Democrats who walked out. There were 17 who boycotted. And it looked to me a couple of dozen had signs and erasable boards. So, what? I mean, I couldn't believe the childish behavior. They dressed up. Some wore pink, I guess, because they like it. I don't – because since when does Trump not like female lawmakers? I don't get it.
I mean, I don't either. And then their protest was completely ineffective. In fact, I think it really helped President Trump. I mean, they didn't even play to a draw last night, the Democrats. They lost yardage when they thought they were going to come in with their protests. I mean, remember when you hold these little teeny signs they had of false whatever, those quickly turned into memes where they get edited. I mean, it just wasn't even thought through. But it reminded me of like going to a high school rally or something. It was childish behavior. In fact, that's probably doing a disservice to high school students in terms of how childish the Democrats were. But I think what I also heard from President Trump were results, securing the border. I think one of the best lines he had last night is that, well, there's all this talk we need to have bipartisan legislation to secure the border. He said, no, we needed a new president. And the numbers, 21 million illegals coming in under Biden's watch, dropping to the lowest number of apprehensions in February in the history of the southern border at less than 8,000. There's a great result. I mean, the recruiting numbers in the U.S. military, as the administration, thanks to Pete Hegseth's leadership, driving the woke, crazy ideologies out of the military, frankly, out of the country, declaring that there's just two genders, common sense. In fact, as we were standing there applauding some of Trump's applause lines around there's only going to be two genders, driving the wokeness out, the idea that we're going to not allow men to compete in women's sports. I turned to a couple of my Senate colleagues that we were standing there applauding, and we said, did you ever think we'd come to a day in America when we're standing up applauding a president for saying something as simple as we can't allow men to compete in women's sports? I think that shows you how far left the Democrats have gone and why they are so out of touch to where most America is.
I know where we stand right now. First of all, what's it like having another senator from your party in your state, Senator Tim Sheehy?
It was great. I was sitting next to Tim Sheehy last night. He was my battle buddy during the State of the Union address, and it was just wonderful to have Tim Sheehy. This is the first time, Brian, in 130 years where Montana's been represented by two Republican U.S. senators, and it was a great night. It was Tim Sheehy's first joint session speech, and to sit there next to Tim, a graduate of the Naval Academy, 200 combat missions as a Navy SEAL. His wife, Carmen, is a Marine, also a graduate of the United States Naval Academy. She was his guest. We were waving at her up in the gallery. And it was a wonderful moment last night, Brian, when Pete Hegseth came around and spoke to both of us, because we were sitting right behind the cabinet, and Pete and Tim Sheehy were just going back and forth on some kind of inside baseball military questions in terms of personnel and so forth. I thought, what a refreshing change to have truly a great American warrior there in the United States Senate representing mm-hmm. Montana, and that's Tim Sheehy.
And also it helps, too, having Secretary Hegseth there, because already the recruiting's gone up. It's been a 15-year high yesterday in December, and I think a 20-year high in January. So it used to be anecdotal. Now we got hard numbers. So the tariffs are a concern for some Republicans. Here's the reaction to Trump's tariffs on Canada, Mexico, and China. Cut 26.
Our tariffs will remain in place until the U.S. tariffs are withdrawn, and not a moment sooner. There are no winners in a trade war.
No hay motivo.
There is no motive, reason, or justification for this decision that will affect our peoples and nations.
The Chinese people will never yield to bullying or intimidation or be deterred by hegemony.
So that was the Chinese interpreter, Mexico, and Canada. Where are we going with this? And what do you think? Is this about drugs, or is this about bringing manufacturing home?
Well, I think the answer is yes. But first, let's start with a fundamental point. Under Joe Biden, our borders were a disaster. National security risk, illegals from the FBI terrorist watch list coming across, the fentanyl. And that's been a point that President Trump has made over and over again. And we talk a lot about the southern border, but let's look at the northern border just for a moment. We seized enough fentanyl just last year on the northern border. I'm a northern border state with Montana, but there was enough fentanyl seized coming in from Canada last year to kill about 10 million Americans. You know, 100,000 Americans died last year from fentanyl poisoning, more Americans dying from fentanyl overdoses every year than the total number of lives lost in the Vietnam War. So this is a serious issue, and President Trump is hitting it head on. Now, let me say this. Howard Lutnick, our Secretary of Commerce, was sitting right in front of us last night. Lutnick was on TV yesterday saying they were in intense discussions with the Mexican government, with the Canadian government, most of yesterday. And so the point is, these tariffs certainly have got their attention of these countries. And these are our friendly neighbors. These are allies, Canada and Mexico. But we've got to address the issue of fentanyl. And then you mentioned the point of manufacturing. That's something the president's very, very passionate about, bringing jobs back to America, bringing investment back to America. And you heard him talk about it, laundry list, where billions of dollars of investment now coming back to the United States, investing in made in America, whether it's semiconductors or automobiles.
Right. So that is effective, but you just wonder, the market didn't seem to like it. Here's what Howard Lutnick did say, though, that gave the market some hope today. Cut 28.
The president's listening because you know he's very, very fair mm-hmm. and very reasonable. So I think he's going to work something out with them. It's not going to be a pause, none of that pause stuff. Mm-hmm. But I think he's going to figure out, you do more and I'll meet you in the middle some way. And we're going to probably be announcing that tomorrow.
So what does that mean to you?
Yeah, well, what it tells me, first of all, is that this administration is operating in a world of reality, not in fantasy. The Biden administration, I think, was living in a fantasy world. President Trump looks at the facts, and that's why he's got great business leaders. I mean, of Howard Lutnick, Scott Bessent at Treasury, you've got Doug Burgum at Interior, you've got Chris Wright at Energy. I mean, these are distinguished business leaders now that are stepping up for public service, and they're going to look at the data. They are also tremendous negotiators. They've worked a lot of business deals. They've worked a lot of transactions. And, you know, Howard Lutnick is on the cutting edge right now on this tariff issue, and he is looking at the data. He's getting input from American businesses, from American agriculture producers, as well as talking to the Mexican government and the Canadian government. I'm confident they're going to land in a good place, but they sent a strong and stern shot across the bow that they are serious about dealing with this issue. America is back, and the world is a lot safer with a strong, decisive commander-in-chief, and that's Donald J. Trump.
One last question. We only got a minute left, but there's two seats that Republicans think they could flip. One's Michigan, one's Georgia. How valuable would Brian Kemp be to get in the race, and what do you expect in Michigan?
Yeah, well, Brian Kemp is a tremendous governor there, of course, in Georgia. Brian Kemp gets in that race, I think we win Georgia. It's as simple as that. That's a pickup seat for us. Remember, it wasn't long ago, coming into the 2020 election, we had two Republican U.S. senators, David Perdue, who's going to be the next U.S. ambassador to China, a very close friend of mine, and Kelly Loeffler, now the heading the SBA for President Trump, both dear, dear friends of mine. What a loss when we lost those two Republican senators. And Georgia has become more conservative, certainly since the 2020 election, more Trump, pro-Trump, certainly. And I think we've got a real good shot. Brian Kemp gets in the race in Georgia. I think we picked that seat up. Michigan is an open seat. Now you've got Gary Peters announced his retirement. Mike Rogers fell less than 20,000 votes short out of millions cast of winning that seat this last election. Mike's a former member of Congress. I think it'd be a great pick for our Senate candidate. Again, think like Dave McCormick. Dave McCormick ran in 22 and lost, came back and ran in 24 and won against an incumbent, Bob Casey. I mean, I think Mike Rogers, he ran once, barely lost. Now it's an open seat. I think you have a real good shot to win it.
All right, Senator Steve Daines, thanks so much. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Brian.
All right, coming up next, the man who allowed me to get into the chamber yesterday, Congressman Dan Mueser of Pennsylvania, will be with us, offering his reflections and his plans. Don't move. Brian Kilmeade Show.
We're going to win so much, you may even get tired of winning.
Taking back America, the first 100 days.
You'll say, please, please, it's too much winning.
Stay with Brian Kilmeade. If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
To further combat inflation, we will not only be reducing the cost of energy, but we'll be ending the flagrant waste of taxpayer dollars. And to that end, I have created the brand new Department of Government Efficiency, DOGE. Perhaps you've heard of it. Perhaps. Which is headed by Elon Musk, who is in the gallery tonight.
And there you go, Elon Musk. He was up there by himself, no kids, no date that I could see. And he kind of mocked the fact that Democrats are not big fans. I really don't sure, if you look at what they're doing, why he would be upset by that, why they would be upset by the efficiency and why they didn't jump in. Maybe my next guest knows. He is Congressman Dan Mueser of Pennsylvania, the 9th District. He's on Financial Services. Small Business Committee can appreciate a guy that's budget conscious from the private sector. He's chairman of the Subcommittee on Oversight and Investigations. And Dan was responsible for the fact that I got into the chamber yesterday. Congressman, we're getting reports that I took your wife's ticket.
Well, I heard that. I heard that from a couple of dozen texts I got this morning. You announced that on Fox. I appreciate that, and my wife was appreciative as well. She was tickled by it. So you're a good man. Hey, I hope you had a good time. Boy, people were thrilled to see you at the speaker's reception prior. And it was a heck of a night. It was a heck of a night. So I really, really
right,
happy that you made it.
I never got behind the scenes like that, and I just thought it was great, and I really appreciate it. Plus, you have the Long Island background, even though you're in Pennsylvania right now, and so is your wife, I understand. But the speaker was not at the speaker's party. How does that happen?
Well, you know what he does? He goes into the other room, and he waits in line to people wait in line to get pictures with him. But something came up, apparently, I think, in a change in the script. And he was advised to that from the White House. But outside of that, everything was standard operating procedure.
And what about for you down there on the floor? I know the Republicans were pumped up, but the other half of the room wasn't. Well, how did it feel to you?
Yeah, you noticed that, huh? I mean,
it's amazing.
It was sort of unbelievable, and it was a little bit sad. I mean, here they're holding up these silly signs, which really are against House rules. That was let go. Al Green, who, made a fool of himself, screaming and yelling about something that wasn't true. You didn't have a mandate to cut Medicaid, and the president has said, read my lips, we're not going to cut Medicaid, and I would say the same thing. I mean, you know, it all started when Melania walks in, and they don't even clap. They sit there with scowls on their face. And I'll tell you something, Brian. When Dr. Jill Biden walked in, the First Lady Biden, we all got up. I mean, if there was one or two that didn't on the Republican side, I certainly did. We stood and cheered and were respectful. I mean, it was just so disrespectful. And then even add to it, you know, the young boy with cancer who got inducted into the Secret Service. No clapping there. Jocelyn Nugari, her 12-year-old was murdered, and you know, they were naming the preservation after her, and no clapping, no nothing. Mark Fogel, for crying out loud, from Pittsburgh, he's stuck in Russia for years under the Biden administration. He's released, and what's interesting, well, his grandmother and his aunt, actually, Malfi, she was sitting two seats away from me. She was sitting right next to Dave McCormick when we were fired upon by that attempted assassination in Butler. So we were with her there, kind of carrying her out. She was a little
where were you, Dan?
I worked up. I was in the front row. And literally when the FBI showed us the trajectories, the bullets were flying a good 18 inches over our heads. Very, very sadly, you know, and the president recognized Corey Comprator, who was shot dead that day, who was protecting his wife and daughter, was probably 12 to 14 feet behind me. And I'll tell you something. One thing that I mentioned this to the president once, that when the FBI went over that with me, not only did Corey protect his wife and daughter instinctively, but that bullet trajectory was heading right for President Donald Trump. So Corey saved his family, and I think there's a pretty good chance he saved the president's life, too.
So let me ask him, do you think we ever got to the bottom of that? I mean, we know nothing about this guy. There was a sense, I read some reports last week, that they do feel like he had help somehow.
Yeah, I'm not happy about it. And Mike Kelly, my good friend, I wasn't put on the investigation I wanted to be since I was there, but I did get interviewed. I'm going to have to talk with Mike Kelly. I know he got a recent latest briefing, but I don't think he's very happy about it either. So you're right. The American people sure as hell deserve answers, as does the president.
What do you got today?
What do we got today? Well,
yeah, aren't you seeing Elon Musk?
I'm seeing Elon Musk tonight, so I'm ready for that. I have a few items for Doge. Some big things, particularly my bill, which is about recovery of overpayments. About the CBO estimated that we deliver overpayments to ineligible beneficiaries to the tune of $236 billion.
Oh, my goodness. 100,
yeah, 100 of which comes out of ineligible payments to Medicare.
Congressman, thanks so much.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Brian Kilmeade coming to you from Washington, D.C., usually from 48th and 6th in Midtown, New York, heard around the country, around the world. Got a busy hour coming your way. We got some special guests. Also, be taking your calls, 1-866-408-7669. Brett Baer is off Kurt Washington, fresh off his great coverage last night. And Rich Lowry at the bottom of the hour of the National Review. Before we get to Brett, by the way, if you wonder where Elon Musk is today, all he's doing, he's got this little thing going on. At night, he's got to meet with congressional Republicans and any Democrats who want to show up. But during the day, SpaceX will launch a 8th suborbital flight test on the fully integrated Starship rocket, a combination of the ship upper stage and the super heavy booster. They want to see if they can get caught in those chopsticks and see if it'll work. If it works, they could be on their way to Mars. Besides that, no reason for him not to spend 3 hours yesterday in the Capitol building. I don't know how he's doing all this. Let's get to the big three.
Number three.
Yesterday and today was a positive step forward to say we are going to negotiate this peace, and we're already talking about confidence building measures that we'll then take to the Russians and test that side. This is going to be a tough shuttle diplomacy, but both sides have to enter into it.
And that is what Mike Walz told me this morning on Fox and Friends. How's that? Zelensky sends a letter to Trump and he seems satisfied. Does it mean the aid will start flowing again? Intelligence will start working again? What about Russia? We examine.
Number two.
Our tariffs will remain in place until the U.S. tariffs are withdrawn.
There is no motive, reason, or justification for this decision.
The Chinese people will never yield to bullying or intimidation or be deterred by hegemony.
Right. That was the Chinese interpreter. Tariffs, rocking markets and nations, including this one. We'll talk about it.
Number one.
Members of the United States Congress, thank you very much. And to my fellow citizens, America is back.
Donald Trump's fifth address to a joint session of Congress, his best and most provocative yet, as Dems make it clear they're not impressed. They act up. They walk out. One tossed out, opposing his presence and policies. It was flat out embarrassing. And that's who we've been talking about. By the way, the Democrats had, I even wrote down the number, how many have walked out. You had 14 walked out, 17 boycotted, and of course you had people were having those erasable signboards, and then you had the small circle sticks where they had messages like he lies or false or Musk is stealing our money. It was just childish. It was absolute idiotic. Elise Stefanik was asked to give the rebuttal, and she's looked at as a moderate. And she gave it. It was quick. It was right to the point. And she's in Michigan. They need Michigan. People think the tariffs the president has out there right now are going to hurt places like Michigan. Ultimately, they will help because they'll bring manufacturing back. For example, Mexico is Honda's now building, moving their plants out of Mexico and bringing it to the U.S. They're going to start building the Civic here. That's part of it. Other people investing. Saudi Arabia is $600 billion, bringing manufacturing back here. In terms of the tariffs, Howard Lutnick weighed in. They might not be around too long. Let's listen, because if they are to get our neighbors to start cracking down on illegal drugs, I think they should take the win because they really seem to be working hard, especially Mexico, arresting 900 cartel members. Cut 28.
The president's listening because you know he's very, very fair and very reasonable. So I think he's going to work something out with them. It's not going to be a pause. None of that pause stuff, but I think he's going to figure out, you do more, and I'll meet you in the middle some way, and we're going to probably be announcing that tomorrow.
Well, we'll see with the announcement. So far, there's nothing scheduled for today. I did see him in the halls last night. I was in the chamber, and he said, well, I don't know about tomorrow. Yeah, okay. Well, he said that to Kudlow. But I think people like the idea of tariffs, but the market doesn't. And that's what the Wall Street Journal does not like it. But I understand you want to balance things out. I like the idea of reciprocal, but punishing Canada, I would either label, and this is what they were telling me last night, if the president just listed how Canada has an unequal relationship, even after the USMCA with us, they would understand more what the tariffs are doing. So I think the president and his staff could go a long way to doing that. And I think it would also help the markets to understand what the goal was, because right now it seems like a lot of things are going the president's way. Give you an example. BlackRock is now taking over the Panama Canal because they're signing contracts on both ends of the canal with the Panama government. Panamanian government knocking out the Chinese country. And that's the first time any country has given up the Belt and Road program. That's a big win. And that's because the president put some attention on it. Yesterday, he brought up Greenland, too. That's a big win. But as he brought this up, Democrats weren't impressed. They weren't cheering for children who overcame cancer. They weren't cheering for widows of law enforcement agents who were killed in the line of duty. I'm talking about Stephanie Diller. AOC at home on Instagram. Listen to her. Cut 22.
Personally, you know, I watched it from home. I paid attention to what the president was saying. I watched it so you didn't have to. So if you didn't, you know, that's okay. I watched the whole thing, but I watched it from home. Everybody makes different decisions.
Okay, I can't take it anymore. What if you have that little to say, how dare you hit play record? But she's out there meandering about it because she knows, number one, you can't just rip Trump anymore in Queens because he's gaining popularity even in New York City. That's why Richie Torres, who's a liberal from the Bronx, is not going out killing Trump. In fact, he is siding, well, he's fighting for Jews in New York. Anti-Semitism is raging. And Cuomo, too. Yesterday, he had a chance to sit down in New York with Stephen A. Smith, another guy from Queens, and he's trying to rehab his image. I mean, you got double figures of women accusing him of harassment. I have no idea why he thinks he can run. But he sat down with Stephen A. Smith, and Stephen A. Smith asked him, what about Trump? Are you going to try to work with Trump? Because today is the day where four Democratic blue city mayors are on Capitol Hill on the Oversight Committee trying to justify their leniency when it comes to criminals and their ambivalence when it comes to illegal criminals and giving ICE access to them. Cut 43.
How are you going to pull this off with the Trump administration in the White House? How would you pull that off for New York City?
Donald Trump is from New York City. Mm-hmm. And he knows our problems here. He knows we need federal help. I dealt with him as governor, remember. So there was a lot of back and forth. He's another one from Queens.
Yes,
right?
He is. Yes, he
three
is.
Three of us, Queens boys. So I dealt with him as governor. He knows our situation. He knows the situation in New York City. It is his hometown. I think that he wants New York City to appreciate him. I think he thinks there's an opportunity for him to do good things in New York City.
So what he appreciated about Andrew Cuomo is the former governor came out and talked about what a sham that trial was that resulted in his conviction in New York City, that nobody else would have been charged with this. And I think President Trump appreciated that. And also Cuomo, by teeing off on Trump, it doesn't benefit you politically. I mean, the same people that were going to vote for you are going to vote for you, and you're not winning anyone over by going after Trump. So, and I think he's gaining popularity in New York, as I mentioned. So he's trying to run. I think he jumps out as the front runner. But on examination of his record, I have no idea why he thinks he should be mayor after he failed so epically as governor. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Back in a moment.
It's Brian Kilmeade. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Small business optimism saw its single largest one-month gain ever recorded. A 41-point jump.
Mr. Green, take your seat. Take your seat, sir. Take your seat. Find it that members continue to engage in willful and concerted disruption of proper decorum. The chair now directs the sergeant-at-arms to restore order. Remove this gentleman from the chamber.
Yeah, so that was it. For the speaker to do that, you know how bad it got. I was surprised they were as tolerant as they were. This guy, Al Green, who we just were informed by Mark Thiessen, who met him in the green room, that Al Green represents the cancer victim that became an honorary Secret Service agent who, before he passed away, when he was 5 or 6 years old, he wanted to visit as many police stations as possible because he always dreamed to be a police officer. And the word is from the family, they didn't think he was going to survive. Thanks to great innovation for medicine, he's able to live at 13 years old. It turns out he lives in Al Green's district. So think about that. Joining us now is Brett Baer. Hey, Brett.
Hey, Brian. Sorry, I'm at this journalism event. It kind of ran over. I apologize.
What event?
It's called the All Britain Journalism Institute. It's they're just kids and folks from all over who are in Washington covering, you know, the starting of journalism. And they just had a panel of folks, and I did a one-on-one interview that lasted a little long, and I took a lot of questions, and I could feel you ringing in my pocket. So
no, wow. Yeah, it wasn't me personally, but I thoroughly understand. I've had that frustration before when people say they're going to keep you on the phone for 5 minutes and it's 15, 20. But the other thing I want to just ask you, did you know that Al Green's district was the place where the cancer victim, that's where he lives?
I did not. I did not. But I tell you what, that was a really sad example. You know, I mean, if you think about all the things we saw last night about Democrats not standing up and, you know, and the president called it out at the beginning, there's nothing I could say that would make them happy over here. But that was such a stark example because it was emotional when he stood up and you saw his eyes light up when the Secret Service director came down and gave him that that badge. And I don't know, it just seemed like a weird moment to sit and not acknowledge that. And the fact that it's Al Green's district and he gets booted at the beginning is even more bizarre.
Yeah, it's well, it was DJ Daniel was his name, and he was just in our green room, and Mark Thiessen put two and two together. But here's the example. I was in the chamber last night, and I had a chance to watch the whole thing. And the weird thing was Sean Duffy went and was talking to Al Green. They must have been talking for 10 minutes. And I thought to myself, that's interesting. He's one of the few Republicans, obviously not a partisan now, he's a transportation secretary, to talk to him. I mean, Al Green, within minutes, stood up and just started screaming. And I'm wondering, was anyone behind that? Because I watched the sergeant at arms, while he was screaming, talk to Nancy Pelosi. And I'm thinking to myself, she's not even the speaker. What are you asking Nancy Pelosi? I mean, were you getting permission to throw him out?
I don't think that. I mean, I think they may have been asking, you know, is this going to go on? Is he going? Is he making a, you know, an orchestrated thing that this was planned? I mean, it was so early in the speech that I think obviously he had every intention of making a scene and getting kicked out in symbolism. I just thought the whole thing, optics-wise, for Democrats, did not work well. Whether it was the bingo placards or the, you know, pink jackets or, you know, sitting on your hands when, you know, there are clearly bipartisan things that are being acknowledged and people who've been through some tough, tough times. You know, the immigration stuff, if the Democrats don't understand that after that election, immigration was a major, major issue. And President Biden said, I've done all I can do. And every Democrat said, you have to do it through Congress or otherwise it wouldn't work. And you go from 200,000 border encounters on the southern border to 8,000. And then the president had that line that was really kind of the line saying, it turns out you just had to have a different president.
And it was a great line. And Pete Hegseth was on with us today, Secretary of Defense. And I said, Pete, you're going down the border again. I'm like, why are you going down there? He goes, because we got to get it to zero. He goes, the president wants it at zero. So border encounters, 8,326 on our southern border, fewer than any month in recorded history. And that was January 2025. The CBP encountered 3,467 illegal aliens in the Del Rio sector, down 72% from 2024. Over 20,000 illegal immigrants were arrested in a single month, at a 627% increase in monthly arrests. So the president has instantly fulfilled one campaign promise. But as David Axelrod says, he thinks the weakness for the president is going to be the economy. Cut 16.
The biggest single issue facing people in their lives is the economy. And what we've seen is that still 75% of the people think the economy is fair or poor. Consumer confidence has taken a dive in the last few weeks. The things that he's doing with the tariffs aren't going to help. And the question is, you know, you can't spend some of these social issues at the supermarket.
Your thoughts about that?
Yeah. Listen, you can walk and chew gum at the same time, and there's a lot of stuff happening all at once. I think getting prices down is going to be a key thing, and I think you heard numerous times in that speech last night, Brian, that the president's acknowledging there may be some short-term pain. He kind of slipped it in ad lib, I think, a couple times, saying, you know, there's going to be disturbances, they're not going to be that bad, the long-term it's going to work out. And I think that that's the biggest question, you know, for folks is what does the disturbance look like? How long are we talking? And what do people feel? You can have some leeway because they're doing a lot of things all at once. But, you know, what is the cutoff before you get to the midterms where that's a big issue?
Going at a minute left, but I just wanted to get your take on where we're going with Ukraine, because it seems like the president was open to that letter. Mike Waltz told me on Fox and Friends that things are moving. He got a call already before his 7:30 a.m. appearance from Ukraine. So do you think we might have some type of announcement today, knowing the cadence of this White House?
Yeah, I do. I also think there's some reporting, and we're having some conversations that Macron, Starmer, and Zelensky may come to the White House for a signing. So I'm not like it's going to happen today, but it may move forward today. And his putting that in the speech about the progress, he doesn't do that unless it's really happening.
Brett, what ratings Friday? Oh, my goodness. Yeah. I told you, everybody knew it was going to be big. What the hell, right?
It was big.
Your biggest ever?
You know, I think Kamala Harris was bigger than that, but it was a big – think about it. Friday at 6 p.m., we beat NBC and CBS, and, it was the number one TV show that night. So we knew it was a big thing. And, you know, Fox is great, as you know. They knew the moment, and they blew a couple commercial breaks. They let it breathe, and we let President Zelensky have the time he needed to make his case.
But you know what? You let it breathe. It'd be very easy to talk a lot, especially with a guy who wrestles with English, and you let it breathe. So we really got understood where he was, and it was he did not apologize. Gave an opportunity, but he didn't. Now he says, I regret what happened. That's where we're at. So Brett, hey, thanks for having me on Special Report. Thanks so much for calling into the show, and I'll talk to you again next week. Thanks, Brett.
Sounds good. We'll see you.
All right. Watch Special Report tonight. Who knows? If all three are going to end up on Special Report. Brian Kilmeade Show. When we come back, we're going to talk to Rich Lowry. Don't move.
The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
I don't know why Donald Trump is scared of Putin. He clearly is. He acts like he's scared of Putin. And right now, with his pause in funding to Ukraine, I just want to let the Ukrainians know to please hang in there. The President of the United States cannot extend that pause because it would be illegal. Congress, on a bipartisan basis, appropriated that funding to Ukraine. Ukraine is going to get that funding.
So, we'll have to see where this goes. And we know that Mike Waltz feels as though they're making tremendous progress to get funding that has already been allocated to them. But keep in mind, when everything was green-lighted, when even Republicans had green-lighted funding reluctantly, along with Taiwan, it was too slow in getting there. No one ever policed the speed in which it got there and the types of weapons that were arriving there, let alone following it through the chain to make sure in their very unique, somewhat challenging democracy that the right people got the weapons. After a while, Ukraine's gotten so good at building their own weapons and their own drones, they're essentially saying, give us the money or give us the steel and technology. We'll put it together ourselves. Joining us now, National Review's Rich Lowry. Hey, Rich, are you encouraged by the letter that Zelensky composed for the president yesterday?
Yeah, but he wouldn't have to be composing any letters to try to crawl back if he just played the game on Friday in the Oval Office, which isn't hard. You know, you just say you really appreciate the president's efforts for peace. You think the war wouldn't have started if he had been president. You want peace, too. You look forward to further conversations. You want to protect your country's interests, but you just look forward to having those discussions. Wash, rinse,
right.
Repeat. Wash, rinse, repeat. And he couldn't do it. You know, he thought he was going to achieve something by having an argument in the Oval Office with J.D. Vance and Donald Trump. And it ended inevitably the way you would have thought. I don't think they should have berated him. If you're going to berate him, you know, end the meeting immediately and berate him behind closed doors. That's what I would have preferred. But Zelensky was either grievously ill-advised or just totally blew it on his own.
One of the lines is, we're ready to work fast to end the war, and the first stages could be the release of prisoners and a truce in the sky. This is to Russia. Ban on missiles, long-range drones, bombs on energy and other civilian infrastructure, and truce in the sea immediately. If Russia will do the same, then we want to move very fast through all the next stages and to work with the U.S. to agree on a final stage. He also went out of his way to note that it was Donald Trump who gave us javelins, and we thank you for that. Regarding the agreement on minerals and security, Ukraine is ready to sign it anytime and in any convenient format. And Brett Baer just told us that he's hearing reports that Starmer and Macron might come with Zelensky to Washington to sign the minerals deal. I guess they want to make sure it comes off this time.
Yeah, exactly. Those guys actually know how to handle Trump. And they have less to lose than Zelensky does, which made Friday really incomprehensible. But I have a friend, Brian, when these must-pass bills are going through Congress, who always says it's hard to tell in the moment whether a bill is actually dying or whether it's seeming to die as part of the process of successfully passing it. So that's the kind of way I look at this Friday, like, oh, my God, you know, is this thing off the rails, never going to get back? Or is this just sort of the process to getting to a yes? Now, it looks as though, as far as Zelensky is concerned, it's the part of the process to getting to yes. Now, we haven't really heard from the Russians yet and what their terms are and what their flexibility is and how willing they are to sign a deal now. And, you know, push comes to shove, I hope and expect Trump will be willing to push the Russians as well. But we have, except for that initial Truth Social post several weeks ago where he said he was considering, you know, more tariffs on Russia if they wouldn't talk peace, all the pressure's obviously been on Zelensky.
Right. And that's what I always said. Put the ball in Putin's court. We don't even know what Putin's voice sounds like anymore. It's been so long since we've heard him.
Right.
And unless you're over in Russia, then he just drones on forever. And now he looks like the good guy for some weird reason, not to anyone who wants to put any of these events in perspective. But now put all the pressure on Putin. Let's see how sincere he is.
Yep.
So and we'll see where we go from here. I would add the Polish prime minister came out and said to all the European leaders, keep calm and carry on. I think that idea that Brett just threw out, it wasn't an idea, but it could be in motion. Trump would love it. The dramatic moments of Zelensky coming with the Macron and Starmer, I think he would love that moment because it would all come to a head. But I also know we have this thing called DocuSign, and I use it for my taxes. So we could just put the rare earth package in a DocuSign so nothing falls apart anymore.
Exactly.
You don't need lunch. You don't need press conferences.
Well, if Starmer and Macron are coming, I hope Zelensky wears a suit. They all wear suits. And Zelensky says nothing in the press availability, wherever it is, the Oval Office or someplace else, and just signs on the dotted line. Because, look, he wants a security guarantee, a real explicit security guarantee. I don't think he's going to get it from us. And the best he can get is the U.S. being entangled, you know, in Ukraine and having business in Ukraine. So this rare earth deal, I think, is good for everyone all around. I would also think, Brian, just when it comes to security guarantees, the ultimate security guarantee is that if this deal comes together and Trump puts it together and gets both parties to sign on the dotted line, that's a huge, probably a top five accomplishment of this term, you know, and he's not going to want to see it busted up. So I think that in itself would be a deterrent against Putin trying anything else, at least over the next 4 years.
I want you to hear what President Trump said yesterday about Russia, 31.
Regarding the agreement on minerals and security, Ukraine is ready to sign it at any time that is convenient for you. I appreciate that he sent this letter, just got it a little while ago. Simultaneously, we've had serious discussions with Russia and have received strong signals that they are ready for peace. Wouldn't that be beautiful? Wouldn't that be beautiful?
So he's laying it out there. I think that meeting Vladimir Putin might be next, or they have a Secretary of State to Foreign Foreign Secretary Lavrov and Rubio together, along with Witkoff or whatever, however they have it. So they also paused, did the U.S., intelligence sharing. I asked Michael Waltz about this a couple of hours ago. Cut 35.
When you read this letter and you went over it with the president, did he say, got it, this is enough for me to move forward? Or do you still need more from the Ukrainian side?
He said, got it. Wish we had heard this last week. This is a good, positive first step. And then directed us to get the details of the negotiations and set those in. And I'll go back to him today and then see what's next.
Is there a chance the pause will be lifted? Because there is a report, too, that intelligence sharing is also stopped with Kyiv.
I think if we can nail down these negotiations and move towards these negotiations and, in fact, put some confidence-building measures on the table, then the president will take a hard look at lifting this pause.
And then get back on the peace process to try to get
We have to know that both sides are sincerely negotiating towards a partial then permanent peace.
Right. And you have not seen anything negative from this letter and some from your conversation.
And the conversation, I have to tell you, the conversation this morning was much better than what we've been having the last several days.
And do you know that in Ukraine, you know, a T-shirt is selling that it has... wear a costume when the war is over, because he got yelled at by a reporter. Why don't you dress normal? Like, why are you wearing that? And he said, I'll wear a costume when the war is over. And that T-shirt is selling in Ukraine. That's the problem. We might not like the way that meeting went here, but they liked it in Ukraine.
Yeah, no, of course. Yeah, it's kind of a rally around the flag effect, at least initially. I don't know whether that would hold if there's truly a breach with the United States, a fundamental breach arising from that meeting. But, you know, I said on X immediately after that meeting, well, why don't you just wear a suit? And people are like, well, Elon doesn't wear a suit. I'd prefer that Elon wears a suit too. But when Zelensky is the head of Doge, he can get away with not wearing a suit. He's not the head of Doge. He's heavily dependent on us in all sorts of ways. And doing a minor gesture, you know, to please the president, that would have been, you know, in the lead of almost all stories, you know, donning a suit for the first time anyone's seen him since the war started, a sign of respect to the president of the United States and the office he was meeting in. You know, just do that. It's, you only have to wear the suit for 6 hours or whatever it is. Then you take it off and don the camouflage outfit or the whatever it is, the sweatsuit again, you know, but they didn't play the game.
Right, they didn't. It's just fascinating that we're seeing all of this and that they make themselves available. Like Mike Waltz came in, I'll talk about it. If you want to talk to the Treasury Secretary, he'll talk to you about the tariffs. You want to talk to the Commerce Secretary? Just call them. They will show up. Rich, you have a perspective going back to Reagan, right? You were a young reporter then, or that might be a little too young for you. Bush 41, 42, 43.
Yeah.
So your thoughts about the transparency that we've seen so far?
Yeah, I mean, it's total access, and in fact, it's probably, you know, too much access, right? I mean, Trump is too open.
In that meeting,
meeting, you know, they should have done two questions, if at all, in that Oval Office meeting, and then take it inside. But he's like, you know, let's just air it out, which is his attitude, and obviously a total contrast with his predecessor, who's not just hiding from the press, was being hidden by his aides because they didn't want people to realize his state, which now the scales have fallen for everyone's eyes, right? We have Jake Tapper writing an expose on the conspiracy to hide his true condition.
About Joe Biden.
Yeah, about Joe Biden, yeah.
Nobody should accept that. I talked about that last weekend. He had not a word to say about that for 4 years. And then now he wants to make money off not reporting it? Come on, Rich. This is the most audacious thing I've ever seen.
Yeah, and at some point he actually blamed the stutter. And his co-author, though, is legit. Alex Thompson, he wrote about this a lot and took a lot of hell for it. I don't know why he just didn't author the book on his own with someone who wasn't implicated in the conspiracy that they're going to write about.
So here's Al Green. Al Green stood up last night, six rows from the president of the United States, and started screaming, waving a cane at him. I hope I never see that again. I don't care who the president is. Here's how he explained himself. Cut 10.
Is yelling during the speech the best way to get that across?
It is the best way to get it across to a person who uses his incivility, against our civility.
Really? I mean, how does this guy get away with this?
That's the most shocking breach we've ever seen. Now, there have been breaches prior to this point. I didn't like Marjorie Taylor Greene and Boebert heckling Biden. I thought that was dumb and wrong. And Joe Wilson, who's a great guy, kind of set the precedent here where he didn't plan anything, but it kind of came out, you know, you lie when Obama was giving an address. But, you know, it was an unplanned interjection, and then he shut up, and I believe he said he regretted it afterwards. This is totally different. This is someone standing up, totally interrupting the procedures, and having been removed from the chamber and expressing no regret. afterwards. It's disgraceful and a terrible look for Democrats. One, just the breach of decorum, but two, to have the breach committed by a 77-year-old angry old man who's waving a cane is like the worst look you could have as a political party.
Lastly, I love the column you wrote about English. The president made, it's an executive order, it made English the official language of the United States. Bill Clinton did the exact opposite. He said, if you want federal funding, you better show me multiple languages on your ATM or any instructions or things to that nature. But you think English, this is a really important step.
Yeah, mostly symbolic. It'll have not that much practical effect. It does repeal that Clinton executive order. But this is, Brian, another example. This would, an average presidency, if a Republican president did this, this would be a months-long debate. It would be shocking that this happened. There'd be so much attention devoted to it. And it basically made, you know, it was denounced by some of the usual characters, but hardly a ripple because there's so much else going on. And this is the advantage of just moving so fast and doing so much. Now, the disadvantage is, you know, sometimes you can make missteps, but the advantage is it just snows under the opposition, which has to choose one or two things to focus on when you've done 10.
Right. But you think it's a bonding thing, you know, and other places where they accept other languages, like in Canada. There's a fracture in Canada. Quebec wants to be its own country.
Language goes very deep to our personal identities, to our national identity. And as I point out in the column, nice, well-run, reasonable countries like Canada, like Spain, have had massive divisions and secessionist movements based around groups that regions that speak another language. So we never want to get to that place.
And you talk about, too, 1.7 million people or a billion people speak English, 400 million use it as their primary language. So we have a good base to jump off of. We're not asking to adapt to some eclectic click language from the bush. This is something that most people speak.
Right. It's the most ubiquitous language there's ever been in the history of the planet. And I would make it just a requirement. If you're coming here as an immigrant, unless, you know, a refugee or an unusual circumstance, but any discretion that we have in admitting you, speaking English is one of the requirements before you get here. And it's not hard. And more people speak English in India than speak English in Britain. About as many or more people speak English in Nigeria than speak it in Britain. So this isn't an ethnic thing. Anyone can learn English, and people all over the world do. And if you want to be an immigrant here, you should learn it.
Rich Lowry, National Review. Thanks so much, Rich.
Thanks, Brian. All the best.
All right, listen, if you want to write me, BrianKilmeade.com, you can do it. Just quick announcement. Coming up, believe it or not, March 22nd, it's coming quicker than you thought, in St. Louis, Missouri. KTFK listeners, hop on board. History, Liberty, and Laughs in conjunction with Fox Nation. Also in June, I'm coming to Dayton, Ohio. WHIO listeners, hope to see you all in person. Tickets are available. It's filling up quick, thankfully. We're flattered. So go to BrianKilmeade.com. Don't move.
Taking America back.
Canada's been very abusive of the United States for many years.
One ally at a time.
It is an act of economic warfare.
The trade imbalance and our trade deficit has gone up 200%+.
Free Canada! Free Canada!
With Brian Kilmeade. The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen, made for your brain.
And I also have a message tonight for the incredible people of Greenland. We strongly support your right to determine your own future. And if you choose, we welcome you into the United States of America. We need Greenland for national security and even international security, and we're working with everybody involved to try and get it. But we need it really for international world security. And I think we're going to get it. One way or the other, we're going to get it.
Well, I think there's going to be a military expansion there at the very least in Greenland. Denmark has been intransigent. And in history, if you look back to other presidents that tried to get it, same thing. Denmark was very possessive of it. But that was when they were more of a imperial power. Now, I mean, what legitimate right do they have for something so far away? I'm not for just taking land. That's what China does. I'm not for that. But, I mean, putting it to a vote of the people of Greenland, but going there and campaigning and finding out what it would mean as a commonwealth. Also, at the very least, expand the area. Expand our military presence. No one minds the military presence there. And I also think it's also easy to point out that Secretary of State Rubio alluded to this last week, that Panama has agreed to it with an American company, I think it's BlackRock, to control both sides of their ports. So China's out. So these are two victories. You look at the border right now. It's virtually sealed already 7 weeks in. That is a huge victory right now. People are pointing out prices haven't come down. Any economist, nobody thought the prices could come down in 7 weeks or go up in 7 weeks, miraculously. The tariffs are rattling people's cages, but that's projection, markets projections of what they would do. Well, let's work it out. But the objective of stopping fentanyl from coming in, watching it get worse, interviewing these families, having them come with him to tell their stories, he wants to make big changes quick. All right. That's a look at this hour. I'm in Washington, D.C. Keep it here on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show, Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Thanks so much for listening. Brian Kilmeade Show. We have a lot going on this hour. Karl Rove is queuing up. He's going to be with us shortly. And at the bottom of the hour, we're going to talk to Josh Krasshauer and talk about politics in Washington. We are in Washington today. Historic. President's comeback complete. No more taking a bow after the 2024 election. He won. The inaugural meant a lot. And last night meant a lot to him. And the first half hour was really letting everybody know, I won, and you tried everything to make sure I didn't. And I don't mind telling you, but the Democrats' behavior was absolutely awful. Joining us now is Karl Rove, former deputy chief of staff for Bush and Fox News contributor. Karl, your thoughts about the speech last night?
Tour de force. He was comfortable, prepared. He mostly read from the prepared remarks. It, you know, sort of cocked his head a little bit to the left and looked at the teleprompter to his right, so that he didn't have to spend much time looking at the Democratic side of the chamber. And I, yes. I thought it was a pretty good address. He made it clear, I'm acting. I'm going to act. I'm going to do what I think needs to be done. Here's what I'm doing. I thought one of the high points was he continually found ways to return to ordinary people. You know, the young kid who's battling brain cancer, whom he made an honorary Secret Service agent, the young Californian who wanted to be the fourth in his generation to serve in the military, had lost his dad, who was a Los Angeles County Sheriff's deputy. The president literally signs his application to West Point. The two young women who were viciously murdered, one of their families was honored with the passage of a law named after her to crack down on violent illegals. And the other, who loved animals, they named it a National Wildlife Refuge near her Texas home. And I thought these were very personal and, you could tell, emotionally connected moments for the president.
Right. And the thing that standing out for a lot of people, even other channels, is the behavior of the Democrats. These erasable signs, these circle signs. I can't believe what I was seeing. I was in the upper chamber by the center camera. And I'd never been there before during any type of event like this. And I'm able to see them writing feverishly, maybe a dozen, mostly women, lawmakers, different signs of whatever came to their mind. Others hanging up false or Musk lies or Musk cheats or Musk steals. And I'm thinking, what are they thinking?
Yeah. Remember when Joe Wilson...
Sure.
Who's a friend of mine, yelled, you lie at Obama. And everybody, Republican and Democrat, you know, lots of people criticized it, and rightfully. And I think even Joe understood that he'd made a mistake. But last night, this was not an isolated member or two. Yeah, Al Green got tossed out, sort of a goofball from Texas, got tossed out for heckling the president. But lots of Democrats were disrespectful and attempting to interrupt the president. And you're right, the stupid little signs. Look, I'm the whiteboard guy. They don't understand the whiteboard. It's to help explain complex ideas, not hurl, you know, moronic insults. And notice today, all those people who were so critical of one member inappropriately yelling at the president are silent because they're Democrats and members of their party engage in wholesale. Please, can we get back to a bit of normality? Can you at least, you know, it would have been smart for them had there been moments where they felt they could join the president in applauding and praising. They could begin to get the stink off of them. But instead, we had, you know, Joe Wilson times, you know, 150, and the media, which was so critical of Wilson, is silent today, or largely silent today.
You know, what's amazing is I looked at those two sergeant of arms, and they did not look like they were the bouncers I'm used to seeing. I need some security. This guy, let's say this guy was younger, and let's say he wanted to take a run at Trump. Was there anybody going to stand in his way? I mean,
oh yeah, no, there are Secret Service. This contingency has been thought about, and don't worry, if they made a president, they would not like the results.
Okay, here's what Speaker Johnson said. Cut 12.
It was not a speech for the mainstream media. It was a speech for the American people. And I'm sure it was received as well at home as it was there by the Republicans and the audience up in the gallery. It was really shameful what the Democrats did. I mean, they really, it was quite a spectacle. They brought shame on themselves and their party. But the American people are following what the president is delivering, and they are appreciating it. And we certainly did tonight in the chamber.
So they, just like you said, it was not geared towards the audience there. But what about the texting on your phones, looking, not even standing up for cancer patients or for kids or widows? It's crazy.
Yeah, no.
Was that orchestrated, do you think?
No, look, that's the problem. I don't think they had a central, you know, command center that said, here's what we're going to do. This was their natural instinct. In my column for tomorrow in the Wall Street Journal, I allude to this. They are frozen in this place by the left-wing ideology of their party, which hates him, which cannot distinguish between the moment and the man. They cannot say, you know what, we're honoring the young man from California who wants to be like his father and his grandfather and his great-grandfather before him to be a member of the U.S. military. Let us stand and applaud that patriotism. No, they can't bring themselves to do that. You know, they can't bring themselves to sit there and listen as they wanted, you know. Again, I go back, you know, when Marjorie Taylor Greene was disrespectful, we heard a lot about it from the Democrats.
We did.
All up and down the line, and the mainstream media. But when the Democrats engage in a wholesale, you know, refusal to you know, be to the minimum of decorum and respect, you know, they're silent. But it's their mistake. You know, this is going to be their problem until they realize that when they sit there and the president talks about parents having a right to know if the schools that their children are going to are privately counseling them to engage in gender transition, they don't seem to understand how out of touch they look when they condemn that by their silence. When the president talks about, you know, other things that he dealt on last night that the vast majority of the American people think are reasonable and respectable, like men not being allowed to participate in women's sport. That was a heart-wrenching story he told about the young woman who suffered brain damage because she was in an athletic pursuit with a man on the other side. So
volleyball.
They don't understand, and if they don't understand, they're not going to get themselves right with the American people.
I don't think I really don't think they're capable of understanding, because they think it's a lack of tolerance. If you tell someone who's transitioning to a different gender, you have to stay with the one you're born with because it's not fair to the other people. Suddenly, women don't deserve the same rights as men, and they're all for it. I want you to. So they've decided that evidently the story goes, if we're to believe it, Cory Booker walked up to Senator Schumer a couple of days before the election and said, on social media, we're getting killed. On podcasts, we're getting killed. And I'm thinking to myself, wow, that's genius. Why don't wait a little longer to tell him? So they decided that they have to change their social media presence. And to me, I go to AOC. Whether you like it or not, she understands social media. Instead, Cory Booker gets the job. And this is what he produces. This is a montage of Schumer, Warren, Booker, and Durbin. Cut 23.
That ain't true. That's what you just heard. Since day one of Donald Trump's presidency, prices are not down, they're up. Inflation is getting worse.
Inflation is getting worse. The cost of groceries, eggs, essentials, it's not getting better.
It's getting worse.
It's getting higher.
Feel better? Do you feel like you're more understanding of Democrats? They're using an expletive to start with, a bunch of 70-year-old guys. I guess they want to sound young by cursing. I don't know.
Yeah, no. Nice try, Corey. Go back to the drawing board. Look, the problem is not first and foremost the channels of communication. It's what they're communicating. It's what they have done for the last 4 years. It is the fact that they have little or no credibility left, because in the main, most all of the leaders of the Democratic Party, with the exceptions of like David Axelrod and James Carville, were saying, "Oh, Biden is at the top of his game. What are you talking about? He's up to this. He's up to four more years of this." So they have little or no credibility, and their views are out of touch with the American people. You know, the Trump won because he won. He was seen as better on issues where it was 60-40, 70-30 his way. I mean, people didn't vote for him. There are a large number of people who voted for him because they love him. But the people who put him over the top said, you know, I may not like him that much, but by God, things were better when he was in office. And I cannot stand four more years of Biden in the form of Kamala Harris, because look what's happened to inflation. Look what's happened to our border. Look what's happened to this whole stuff with woke and DEI. Look what's happening to our great institutions. Look what's happening to our deficit. So, you know, their problem is not that they just haven't figured out the best way to get their message across on TikTok. Mm-hmm. It's that their message stinks. And until they change their message like they did in 1992 with Bill Clinton, they're not going to be in a good place.
So talking to Karl Rove, obviously, Karl, the Wall Street Journal was one of the first to have a major story talking about the cognitive decline of Joe Biden. And they got huge blowback from that. It's a place you contribute a column to every week for years now. And now there's books coming out. Now we hear more and more reports about it. And now there's a book coming out that CNN anchor Jake Tapper, they say, co-wrote, that talked about the cover-up of Joe Biden's decline. And Bob Woodward, in the interim, wrote a book and did not unveil that Joe Biden seemed to be failing just a few times, which he repeated a story a few times. What does it tell you about Bob Woodward, the ultimate reporter, and what does it tell you now that CNN, with a straight face, will try to write the Joe Biden story?
Well, I guess books sell. I mean, look, Jake Tapper's a smart guy. I've known him for a long time. He's a man of the center left. He doesn't understand that that's obvious to people. But he was, you know, an apologist. And now he's going to have a book in which he unveils the information which he now knows about how Joe Biden was not up to the job and the White House hit it. But, you know, Bob Woodward I respected journalist. I've known him a long, long time. He's written some important books. He obviously played an important role in Watergate. But he thinks that he is perfect. I had a minor disagreement in a book that he wrote about the Bush years, a factual disagreement. It was something that was just simply not factually accurate. It wasn't a major point, but it was a minor point. And he was deeply affronted when I told somebody that he was mistaken, and literally confronted me to say, I never make mistakes. Well, look, we're human beings. We all make mistakes. And sometimes they're bigger than other mistakes. Tapper, if he knew that Biden was in mental decline, as a journalist, he had a responsibility to report on it. And maybe he didn't know at the time. Others did. And others got excoriated for raising respectfully questions about whether or not their party, the Democratic Party, should be nominating somebody who thought that his best years were going to be between the ages of 82 and 86.
And yeah, and he's still mad that he didn't have a chance to beat Trump. Can you imagine if he was able to go campaign 5 days a week?
Yeah. This is sad. In fact, if I have one criticism to make about the president's speech last night, he wasted too much time attacking Biden. Biden is better forgotten than assailed. I mean, you know, it's just too easy to beat up on him. But, you know, it's remarkable that the Democrats, I mean, Biden, what was he thinking? I could have beaten Trump? My God, yes. Man, have you ever looked at your own performance on June 27th? Is your wife so insular, your sister so focused on what's best for the Biden family that you did not understand that this was bad for America, bad for the Democratic Party, bad for the world, that the president of the United States would be somebody who was as out of it as much as you were? I mean, it's just astonishing to me. And, you know, again, the Democrats are in the hole because they're stuck with Biden and stuck with 4 years of what Biden did to our country and our economy and our border. And until they figure that out, they're not going to get out of the hole.
I hear you. Carl, I look forward to seeing you soon. Thanks so much for joining us. It's going to be an interesting 3¾ years.
Yes, sir. Buckle up, Buttercup.
I hear you. Thanks so much, Carl Rove. 1-866-408-7669. Bottom of the hour, we go inside politics when we come back. The latest on what's happening with these mayors testifying in Capitol Hill, these blue state mayors, about how they're trying to legitimize their sanctuary city status and their lack of cooperation with ICE. Don't move.
Increasing your intelligence quotient.
What the hell did you just say?
It's Brian Kilmeade. He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
The Democrats seem to be falling into trap after trap after trap as he recognized these people and celebrated the people he pointed to in the gallery and their stories while the Democrats sat glumly on their hands through all of that. It was a terrible look. Al Green's attempt to disrupt the speech was a bad look for the Democrats. This was, I think, politically speaking, this was pretty powerful stuff, as powerful as I think I've heard.
Right. And Brid Hume said, look, it was partisans that we were used to. And Mark Thiessen mentioned the same thing. Brid's covered it. Mark Thiessen's written, too, lead writer on two State of the Union addresses. I'm not used to that partisan, but it was really good. It was good, solid speech. And he said the one thing that was brought up, I think, by Mark this morning was you're going to need some bipartisan support on some of these issues. You can't do everything on reconciliation. So you got to find some things to win people over. And outside Fetterman, who can you work with on the left who needs to do something? And one was Elise Slotkin. And she is the senator from Michigan who barely beat Mike Rogers. And she did it by saying, I'm CIA. I'm a CIA person. I'm thinking about intelligence first, thinking about national security first, kind of ran from Kamala Harris that was intentional. Here's a little of her address in the counter argument. Cut 19.
After the spectacle that just took place in the Oval Office last week, Reagan must be rolling in his grave. We all want an end to the war in Ukraine. But Reagan understood that true strength required America to combine our military and economic might with moral clarity. And that scene in the Oval Office wasn't just a bad episode of reality TV.
So that was the most emotional she was. For the most part, she delivered a dispassionate address. And that is a seat, and that's a state. The Republicans really think they could flip. Gary Peters said, I'm not doing this anymore. So the seat is wide open, that one next to her, that Mike Rogers almost won. You heard Steve Daines on with us earlier. He's the senator from Maine. Excuse me, the senator from Montana. And the senator from Montana, who was in charge of getting flipping the House red, Senate red, he said, I think Mike Rogers would be great for a rematch right there, that Dave McCormick did lose the first time in Pennsylvania, ended up winning the second time. And we'll see how that goes. So Slotkin came out, and she wants to build off the tariffs she thinks are a bad look. She thinks that there could be a little bit more order to the cuts. But the moderate position clearly is the one that Democrats should be going for. Pick and choose the spots that you want. When it gets close to the midterm, separate yourself, not from your voting record, and say, this is where I'll be better. Trump's done in 2 years. Let's make a lame duck. Let me show you the direction I'll have. But nobody wants the direction that we saw last night. People yelling at the president, holding up little bids from auction houses, the little circle signs, and the other one with dry erase boards. So that was crazy. 14 people walked out. 17 people boycotted. That's not going to win you back the House or with the Senate.
information you want, truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
But we're going to find out where that money's going. And it's not going to be pretty. By slashing all of the fraud, waste, and theft we can find, we will defeat inflation, bring down mortgage rates, lower car payments and grocery prices, protect our seniors, and put more money in the pockets of American families.
And that's a little of the president's speech last night that was well received for the general public, but Democrats were ambivalent or they didn't show up. As I mentioned, 17 boycotted, 14 walked out. Others held signs. And with us right now, Josh Krasauer, Fox, great friend of the show, Fox News radio political analyst and editor-in-chief of Jewish Insider. Josh, overall, who gained from last night?
Well, look, it's always the advantage to have the podium to be on offense, and certainly President Trump was on offense last night. It was a very partisan speech, and it was a very partisan reaction from the Democrats who were in the chamber. Look, I think Trump benefited. He focused on a lot. The anti-wokeness was a big theme of the speech. I think he hit on a lot of issues that are 80-20 issues that divide the Democratic Party and unite the Republicans. Tariffs, though, I think it was a little bit of a trickier situation.
The market leading up was not helpful.
Not at all. And I don't think he convinced even some skeptical. I saw John Thune not clapping at times when Trump was making the push for tariffs and additional tariffs apparently in April. But that's not going to be popular, especially with the potential for prices to go up. A lot of Republicans are worried about the politics of that issue. You know, Trump did not talk a lot about foreign policy, did a couple minutes on Ukraine, but that's also another issue where I think he has a lot to worry about. And I thought it was interesting that even though that was a story that dominated the last week, they didn't spend a whole lot of time talking about it in that address last night. But overall, he really was on offense and highlighted the stories, the really compelling stories. Mark Fogel, the hostage who was held by Putin in Russia for several years, was released. He was there. It was quite a moment. The 13-year-old kid who now is a Secret Service agent, the cancer survivor. Very compelling story. A very Reagan-like playbook, going to people in the audience and talking about their stories and what he's done for them. Also talked a lot about immigration, border security. That was one of the big issues that got him the election. And he certainly views that as a big success story in these first 6 weeks, and one that is going to continue to give him political gains.
You're one stewing right now, and there's an oversight committee hearing at the Sanctuary City Mayors to facing Congress. You got the Boston mayor, you have the Chicago mayor, you have the Denver mayor, you have the New York mayor, and they all paid a lot of money to get consultants to get ready in order not to get blitzed like the Ivy League presidents did last year. I don't know how it's going, but I imagine this is going to get explosive. How do you defend not cooperating with ICE, pro-illegal immigrant criminal?
And these are some of the most unpopular mayors in the country, largely not only because of how they've handled the migrant illegal immigrants and migrants in their cities, but handling crime, handling basic services that a city has to provide. I mean, Brandon Johnson, I believe he's there. 6% job approval rating, 6% in Chicago. You can't get much lower than that. And this is it's a political win for Republicans anytime they highlight the inadequacies of the leadership of these deep blue cities.
A.G. Bondi said that she's an insult, is the mayor of Boston, to law enforcement because what she's done to do it. And yesterday, we know what she did a few days ago. There was a stabbing that led to the death in a Chipotle of someone randomly stabbing an off-duty cop. Kills the assailant, and she, her heart, not thoughts and prayers, thoughts go to the families, the family of the stabber.
Yeah. You have this wave of far-left mayors that have gotten elected, prosecutors too, in these very deep blue cities. And what you're seeing politically, Brian, is there's a backlash even among Democrats. So Michelle Wu, I mean, that was just such an egregious moment, shows how she's more sympathetic towards the perpetrators of crime than the actual victims. And Bob Kraft's son is running against her in the Boston mayor's race, running as a much more moderate candidate.
Wait, Bob Kraft?
The New England Patriots owner, his son is running against Michelle Wu in the mayor's race. And he's running as a common sense moderate, a Democrat, but a moderate Democrat. You know, San Francisco just ousted their progressive mayor for a more business-oriented Democratic candidate. You got Cuomo in New York. He's running that same playbook. Chicago is probably going to see – Rahm Emanuel, I'm hearing, might run for mayor again in Chicago. Yeah, that's what I'm hearing from my Democratic sources in Chicago. So, like, there is this backlash even among Democrats. They're looking at these far-left mayors that have been indulging crime, indulging these illegal immigrants, and they think there's a time for change, in addition to the Republicans that have been saying this for many years.
So I love that Trump has taken on anti-Semitism on college campuses. I love that he's now – saying that you're going to lose federal aid if we find that you're not protecting the Jewish students. So he put on Truth Social, all federal funding will stop for any college, school, or university that allows illegal protest. Agitators will be imprisoned or permanently sent back to the country in which they came. American students will be permanently expelled or, depending on the crime, arrested. No masks. Thank you for your attention to this matter. This has got to be controlled. This is out of control.
It is remarkable how just the simple threat that you're going to face consequences has led these universities, these very, you know, left-wing universities like Columbia, like Barnard, they've actually started to expel students who are threatening Jewish students, threatening professors. There was an incident at Columbia where you had an Israeli studies class being threatened and harassed and interrupted by these mask-wearing thugs. They two of them were expelled, and that's in large part because they know the pressure's coming from the Trump administration and indulging pro-terrorism activists, pro-Hamas protesters. That's not going to fly anymore, and they could actually lose a lot of their funding, federal funding, if they continue to not change their
So 13 ways. American universities are slapped with an F grade on anti-Semitism. A couple of them with F grades, California Polytech State, DePaul, Evergreen State College, Haverford College, Loyola University, New Orleans, Pfizer College, Pomona College, Portland State, Scripps, the New School of Manhattan, and Cal State Santa Barbara, and Illinois Chicago, the University of Minnesota. I love it. Because if you're a Jewish kid or you're offended by the anti-Semitism, why would you go to that school?
You should – if you're Jewish and you support Israel, you should be able to walk across campus, not be threatened, not be harassed. It's pretty simple stuff.
Don't you think that was something that – you think I'd crazy if I said that? I know prior to, I guess, the pandemic or prior to Gaza?
Look, I think a lot of people lost their minds on the left in the last 5 years. They're now – you now see elements of the left indulging this Hamas – pro-Hamas protest. And these protesters have gotten more radical, you know, since October 7th. They've gone off the charts extreme. And these people, some of them not even here legally, right, are supporting terror groups that should not be tolerated.
Josh, thanks so much. Interesting speech, interesting aftermath. It's going to be an interesting weekend. Keep it here. When we come back, Pete Hegseth joins us. Don't move. Hey, welcome back, everybody. Today on Fox and Friends, I'm in Washington, D.C. I was with Fox and Friends prior to my radio show. I had a chance to meet Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth. We had a 6:30 a.m. time slot. Why did I think it would work for him? Because he spent the last, 15 years getting up for Fox and Friends earlier than that, and he was ready to go this morning as we talked about the speech last night. We talked about the challenge he faces, the adjustment with his new job, and why he was going to the border. We begin with a cut from the moment where Donald Trump singled out his new Secretary of Defense.
Our service members won't be activists and ideologues. They will be fighters and warriors. They will fight for our country. And Pete, congratulations. Secretary of Defense, congratulations. And he's not big into the woke movement, I can tell you. I know him well. I am pleased to report that in January, the U.S. Army had its single best recruiting month in 15 years, and that all armed services are having among the best recruiting results ever in the history of our services.
They're not supposed to be smiling and clapping, just so you know. That was President Trump talking about U.S. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, and he did it right in front of him. And we just watched that together because Pete's in studio. The Secretary
hey, Brian,
of Defense,
good to see you.
Great to see you. What a start you've had. What did that feel like to have the president talk about the one thing you always focused on? Let's build up the military. Let's find out about what's going wrong with recruitment. And he says there's already a difference in 7 weeks.
Well, the brave men and women of America have stepped right up. When they see who their commander-in-chief is, what his focus is, back to basics, warfighting standards, accountability and readiness, they're ready to raise their right hand and join the U.S. military. And from the Marine Corps, to the Army, to the Air Force, to the Navy. We've seen record numbers across the country of Americans saying, I want to serve under the Commander-in-Chief, President Trump. So it was a cool moment to hear him announce that there. The military has responded. It's a renaissance in the Pentagon, for sure. And it was a historic night. The president gave a historic, strong America First speech, and it was surreal to be right in the front row.
And before I go on to the issues, just for you personally, to walk down that aisle as a member of his cabinet and to sit in that front row, we all watched it and covered it the next day. But what was it like for you?
You're right. We've watched it. It was an honor. You know, and I don't mean to deflect, but it's even more of an honor to have a front row seat to watching him be president of the United States in the Oval Office on an almost daily basis, making decisions about what we're going to focus on, what we're going to prioritize, how we're going to bring peace. His commitment to following through on his campaign promises is historic. So nothing surprised me about what he delivered last night, and I was proud to be there.
So you're going to go after this, you're going to go to the border with the vice president. You're also bringing more troops to the border. The numbers are staggering. Your thoughts about what is the mission right now? Is it down to zero?
Almost, and not quite to zero yet. 97% drop, Brian. Historic lows of crossings. The deterrent effect is there. We've brought in the military alongside Tom Homan and Secretary Noem.
Look at those numbers.
Oh, it's 98.8%. I mean, we're talking gotaways in the single digits, Brian. President Trump gave us a charge. 100% operational control of the southern border. Border security is national security. Over 20 million people, as the president pointed out last night, poured in across our open border policy, which created recklessness, death, drugs for our communities. We're sending those folks home, and we're not letting more in. And you're seeing that right now.
Are you hearing that Mexico's cracking down, too? Because they evidently arrested 900 cartel members. They seem to be on the offensive on their southern border. Are you seeing enough cooperation?
I mean, my message to Mexican leaders and Mexican military leaders has been, we want to cooperate with you, and we will cooperate with you. But if you don't police up the cartels on your side of the border, then we'll be forced to do it for you. We don't want to do that. So right now, we have historic cooperation, military to military, but we're letting them lead. It's their country. It's their fight. We want them to lead that fight. So far, they have stepped up, which is a very good sign.
If we hear about ISIS or Al-Qaeda leaders anywhere, we're taking them out. If the cartels are now a terror group, we look at them as a terror group, will we take them out just like they're in Yemen, just like they're in Sudan, just like they're in Syria?
I mean, Brian, you heard the president of the United States last night, just like I did. They're a designated foreign terrorist organization. We will not accept them controlling that border, poisoning our people with fentanyl, which those numbers have not gone down enough, which is why the president has continued tariffs on Mexico. So we are all options, as I've said, are on the table. We would prefer that the Mexican government handle it themselves, and we hope they do, and we're partnering with them to do so.
All right, let's change gears. As the speech wrapped up last night, this was posted by the Chinese embassy. Quote, if war is what the U.S. wants, be it a tariff war, a trade war, or any other type of war, we're ready to fight till the end. As Secretary of Defense, how do you take that?
Well, we're prepared. Those who long for peace must prepare for war. That's why we're rebuilding our military. That's why we're reestablishing deterrence and the warrior ethos, is because we live in a dangerous world with powerful ascendant countries with very different ideologies. You mentioned defense spending. They're rapidly increasing their defense spending, modern technology. They want to supplant the United States. If we want to deter war with the Chinese or others, we have to be strong. And that president understands peace comes through strength. He also has a great relationship with that gentleman right there, too, Xi Jinping. So where we can partner, where we can cooperate to recognize that we don't want war with China, we don't seek that war, we will. And the president has sought historic peace and historic opportunities. But my job as the Secretary of Defense is to make sure we're ready. We need the defense spending, the capabilities, the weapons, and the posture in the Indo-Pacific, which is something we're very much focusing on.
China has said they're going to up their defense spending 7.2%. And that's supposedly with a struggling economy. We're getting mixed messages on that. As Secretary of Defense, you always want more money.
Absolutely.
At the same time, DOGE is in there cutting back and speeding up the systems, making it more efficient. How much money are you asking for when you talk to the president or when you talk to the Treasury Secretary in this budget? How much more do we need? Because we watched it, not the defense spending was not even keeping up with inflation over the last 4 years.
My message has been, I'm both a fiscal hawk and a defense hawk, and I think America First represents both with peace through strength. So DOGE is going to cut fat where we need to, and we're going to reprioritize on the right thing. So it's not about a fixed dollar amount, Brian. It's about addressing the president's priorities, Golden Dome, southern border, modernization, hypersonics, UUVs, UAVs, the fight of the future against China. They know we're serious, and we're building for that.
So let's talk about the big announcement yesterday, the mastermind behind the Abbey Gate bombing that injured so many and killed 13. Captured is coming here. Special thanks to Pakistan. What could you tell us?
Well, special thanks to Pakistan, indeed. We cooperated with us. But this started, I want to be very clear, under this administration. We had our leadership, Director Radcliffe and others in CENTCOM and in the military, passing information to the Pakistanis who helped us action it after this president was elected. So this is a president who saw what happened, the debacle in Afghanistan, and said, when I'm president, I will make sure those held accountable, those who perpetrated the death of 13 Americans and the injury of dozens others, we will find them. We will keep our word. We partnered with the Pakistanis. Based on intelligence we provided, they nabbed him, positively identified him. We've known that for a few days. He's on his way, I believe, already in the United States, and will face justice. You see, what had the Biden administration done? So it happened, and they wiped their hands of it and said it's the best airlift in American history. We're not going to hunt these guys down. President Trump never forgot.
And you're
delivered at the State of the Union.
And you're doing an investigation, your own investigation, into what went into the decision to evacuate that way in Afghanistan?
Because, Brian, no one was held accountable. It was one of the biggest disasters in American history, an embarrassment, a black eye to our country. We handed over billions of dollars equipment to the Taliban. We counted on them for our security, and then we got people killed. We gave away Bagram Air Base, and no one in military leadership was fired? Nuh-uh. That's not going to sail under President Trump. So we're doing a full review and investigation of what happened in Afghanistan. Those who were involved and made the decisions that put our troops at risk will be held accountable. I've stated that before, and we're continuing to be committed to it.
Just real quick, J.D. Vance was misinterpreted, perhaps, when he said 20,000 soldiers helping out Ukraine who haven't fought a war in 20 years is not going to be helpful. And the U.K. said that looks like you're putting us down as fighters, and that's making a lot of international news. You fought with the British. You've told me before you have great respect for them as fighters.
J.D. Vance is an incredible vice president. He's just been fantastic. And he's said what I've said, which is NATO needs to step up, whether it's the French or the British or others who we've fought with in certain conflicts. And I have served in Afghanistan with great British soldiers. The question is, will their government step up and provide that security guarantee with European troops?
Right.
The vice president recognizes the necessity of that, as do I, and we're hoping they will step up.
Mr. Secretary, I know, thanks for your first stop en route to the border.
It's good to see you, brother.
The only guy, the one secretary I know that can handle early morning hours. Thanks. Great to see you. Congratulations
again.
Say
hi to everybody in New York.
I know, and we miss you a lot, but you're doing a great job.
So great to see Pete, his wife Jen, come in, and Tammy. Believe it or not, Jen and Tammy, who's now his chief of staff, essentially heading all of his media opportunities, controlling his schedule, both were fantastic producers at Fox. So I look forward to maybe catching up with the Secretary of Defense on the road. Thanks so much for coming by. Keep it here on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
This week on the Brett Baer Podcast, my all-star panel weighs in on the top stories at home and abroad. Fox News senior White House correspondent Peter Doocy, host of The Guy Benson Show, Guy Benson, and Fox News political analyst Juan Williams.
Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcast.com. Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.